Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. We are back live and direct. Today, it's me, your host and co-editor, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, a history chappie on Twitter, Instagram, and all those other social media platforms on behalf of the Versus History editorial team. But it's not me. That's the important one. It's our distinguished and special guest. It's Des Powell, who has co-authored a book with Damian Lewis, one of our previous podcast guests, and it's entitled SAS, Bravo 3-0. It's published by Quercus Books towards the end of October 2021, so it will be available very, very soon. Now, I'm not going to say too much about the book because I'm going to leave that to the man himself. Des, welcome to Versus History. We're delighted to have you with us.
Patrick, thank you very much for inviting me on the show.
Oh, the pleasure really, really is all ours. I spoke to Damien a couple of times, and no pressure, Des, but he always gives fantastic interviews, and I'm sure you're no different. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about the book that you've come to write and your formative experiences that have gone into the writing of it. Over to you. Tell us all about you.
Okay. I come from Sheffield. I'm Sheffield born and bred, and I left school when I was 15. And I went into the steelworks, in the big steel city, so to speak. I wasn't really pleased with that, and I finished up a few years later joining the armed forces, and I joined the parachute regiment. And it was a little bit late, really. I was around about 19, going on 20 years old, which is a little bit late to join the armed forces. But I really enjoyed it. I served in the parachute regiment for approximately 8.5 years, and I did tours of Northern Ireland, Cyprus, Germany, and Hong Kong, and really enjoyed my time within the parachute regiment. After 8.5 years, I got more serious, and I thought, right, I want to go and join the Special Air Service Regiment, the SES. And I had a very long career within the regiment. I served there for over 19 years. Within the regiment, I joined Air Troop. Air Troop, you specialize in high altitude free fall parachuting. And I also specialized in VIP protection, which is sometimes termed as a bodyguard protection. I also specialised in training and techniques in anti-terrorism, not only within the SAS, but also within special forces around the world. I also was lucky enough to work in many theatres around the world. Mainly, we term this in the SAS as covert operations or clandestine operations, if you like. I also was trained in medics and demolitions and signals, and also managed to learn a couple of languages as well. And I really enjoyed my time within the regiment itself by traveling around the world and getting involved in a lot of stuff that you wouldn't normally do in the normal army, so to speak. My total service, including the parachute regiment and the SES, was in total of over 28 years. After the military, I went into the civil sector, and this is termed the circuit or the media circuit. And this is working for high ranking media organizations, mainly working in war-torn countries or volatile countries, mainly in the Middle East, Africa, and South America. I did that really, and what it was is using my skills that I learned in the special forces, and it was really VIP protection for these media groups. I did that for a couple of years, and I really enjoyed it. And then after that, I went further on into the civil sector, which is termed the celebrity circuit. And this is VIP protection at this time for celebrities. In the area of football, I did security for Spurs Football Club and for such players as Jamie Redknapp, Les Ferdinand, and Robbie Keane. In the television, I looked after Jeremy Kyle and Jim Davison. And in the film world, I worked on the Bond film sets, where I looked after such celebrities as Pierce Brosnan and Halle Berry. And I, again, I really enjoyed that. That more or less brought me up to date, and I'm now living in UK, and I divide my time between UK and the UAE, mainly Dubai, where I used to live.
Wow, that is some CV. That must run into some pages. If you were sent away to a desert island, that's your scenario, for 5 whole years, and you can only take the following with you. There's one musical album, one drink aside from water, you've got unlimited supplies of that, and one book with you for company. What would they be and why? So one album, one drink, and one book, just to try and get to know the Des pal behind the CV. Over to you.
Okay, music. I can go the full range, actually. Some days I can listen to Frank Sinatra. I can bring it further up to date and listen to Michael Bublé. But then I can be really modern, and I actually like Bruno Mars. But just lately I've been into music which is on the internet called Postmodern Jukebox. And what that is, it's modern day music, but they put all sorts of, for example, they may add jazz to it, or they may add rap to it, or they may add swing to it. So you can have modern day music with a different theme. So I've been listening to that, and I quite like that. So, it would probably be music from Postmodern Jukebox, because you tend to get a lot of variety, if you like.
Good choice.
I think, okay, you put me on the spot, so I'll pick one. I'll tell you what, let's pick an album by Michael Bublé, okay?
Go for it. I like that. It will certainly be fitting at Christmas. All right, that's the album. What drink you're taking with it?
Okay, so I'm a non-alcoholic drinker. I don't drink alcohol, but what I do, especially lately with the book coming out, I spend a lot of my time in coffee bars drinking coffee, and I like cafe lattes. And my eldest son has got me interested in oat milk lattes. So if it was possible that I could take a drink on this island, I realise I might need a coffee machine. But any cafe latte drink, and I'm, as I said, I'm particularly fond of these oat milk lattes now. So if that's if I could do that, that would be nice.
Yeah, you certainly can. All we need from you now is one book or magazine or publication for a bit of light reading. What would you say, apart from your one, obviously?
Yeah. So what I do, I'm into personal development, Patrick, you know, and I was in the USA some years ago, and I managed to meet up with Anthony Robbins, and I quite liked his seminars on personal development. But we have a guy here in the UK, and he's brought out a book called, quite a few years ago, called Warrior by Jeff Thompson. And he says in the book, where have all the warriors gone? And he talks about the modern day warriors, not only men, but women as well. And it's a great book by Jeff Thompson. So if I was going to take a book onto this island, the Warrior would be the one I would take.
Cracking trio of choices, Des. Thank you very much indeed. All right. The question about your book then, please set the scene for us. What's it all about in short, and why is it so important right now?
Yeah, my book is called SES Bravo 3-0, and it's about the Cold War back in 1991. And I think most people can remember the story of Bravo 2-0 by the author Andy McNab, and he talked about the problems that his patrol had out in Iraq at that time. What a lot of people don't realise is that there were three patrols, Bravo 1-0, Bravo 2-0, and my patrol, Bravo 3-0. Our mission was to find and locate mobile Scud rockets that were being fired from the Iraqi desert into neighboring countries with the intention of creating instability within the Middle East and actually creating a massive war within that part of the world. And undoubtedly, it would bring about a massive loss of life. And it was our job to prevent that. The reason I'm pleased about this book coming out is that they've now given me permission this year to actually write about my story. And the publication is coming about soon. And I'm pleased because it's a great book, and not only in terms of modern history, but I think in the book there's something for everyone. Not only does it talk about the mission itself and the problem, but it talks about all the missions that I've been involved in. And also it talks about certain areas of my life as well. So, yes, it's a great book, and I'm sure people will like it.
Thank you very much, Des. All right, I know this isn't the focus of the book, but there may be a good few people out there that have never really heard of the First Gulf War or never studied it. So could you very, very briefly outline as quickly and concisely as you can the key causes and events of that Gulf War so people can just orientate your book into the wider history and contextualize it? So the Gulf War, what caused it and what happened, in short? Over to you.
Yes, back in the late summer of 1990, Iraqi military forces invaded Kuwait. This came about really because the leader at that time, Saddam Hussein, had been at war for many, many years, in fact, all through the 80s, with its neighbor, Iran. And they had been locked in fierce fighting, with the result of approximately 500,000 people dead. What Saddam had done because of his fighting with Iran, it virtually bankrupted his country. He was looking towards oil-rich Kuwait, a bordering country, as the answer to his problems. He was also, by the invasion of Kuwait, sending out a strong message to the rest of the world that Iraq was the biggest and strongest country within the Middle East. And now he had an army which was the third largest in the world. And now he was a force to be reckoned with. So because of this, the United Nations gave him an ultimatum for him to withdraw his troops by the 15th of January 1991. Because of this, we saw the largest formation of troops ever since the Second World War. There was hundreds of thousands of troops that formed up within Saudi Arabia. In fact, they were called multinational coalition forces from all countries around the world. And they formed up in Saudi Arabia, ready to cross the border into Iraq and Kuwait to oust Saddam Hussein from Kuwait itself. The objective was quite simple, the liberation of Kuwait itself. So the scene was set. Saddam had invaded Kuwait. We had the largest forces that we'd seen since the Second World War. Commanders were seeing it that there was going to be instability within the Middle East, and it was possible that there was going to be a massive war. And this meant a massive loss of life.
Thank you very much indeed. You did a great job with that one. Okay, then, segueing back to your personal experiences within this conflict. One of the episodes discussed in the book is how you were part of a low-level insertion into Iraq on board an RAF Chinook helicopter, which took a turn for the worse when it was suddenly locked onto by a Western coalition fighter jet. The helicopter was thrown around the sky by the pilot in an attempt to get free, ejecting Chafe to divert any incoming air-to-air missiles. The fact you're here today is proof that you escaped with your life. Could you tell us more about that harrowing, obviously distressing episode, which you talk about in the book?
Yes, in fact, my mind's going back now. I remember it was a very testing, and I don't mind saying a scary time. Just to set the scene even further, the Chinook helicopter that we're in is a large twin-engine heavy lift helicopter. This helicopter is 30 metres in length, and it weighs several tonnes. It can travel in excess of speeds of over 300 kilometres an hour. And the pilot was flying this only 50 foot off the ground. And he was doing this, in fact, they call it nap of the earth flying. And he does it so we can evade radar being detected. And it was a strange feeling, a strange scenario, if you like, is that we are, quite a few hundred miles inside enemy territory. We are traveling at high speed, only 50 foot off the ground. And now it looks like we're going to be shot down by a coalition aircraft, just simply because they don't know we are. The chaff that was being thrown out from the aircraft is a way of diverting a heat-seeking missile coming from an aircraft. And it is a strange experience because the only way I can describe it is like fireworks that's being set off all at once. You're in the aircraft and you'll see all this light outside. And it was confusing because I'm not sure whether we're receiving a small arms fire from the ground or whether a rocket was inbound. And yes, it was a very, very scary experience. At one stage, we were so low going towards the ground that I thought we were going to crash. As you can imagine, the aircraft was leering to the left and then leering to the right, just to evade this lock-on from this aircraft. What I realised, Patrick, is that there's not really much you can do because you're a passenger on that aircraft. And it dawned on me that here we are on this aircraft, behind enemy lines. No one knows we are there. And we, in fact, have been mistaken for an enemy aircraft. And I thought to myself is that we've only just started this mission. And there's a very good chance we're going to be shot out in the sky. But testament to the Special Forces air crews that I'm here today and speak about this incident actually shows you how good these pilots are. But no, I don't mind saying that it was a very, very scary experience. And it's not something that, you want to happen too often.
Absolutely. The harrowing tales don't stop there, because another episode of your book talks about another fight for your life, which was environmental this time, when Iraq suffered perhaps its coldest winter on record back in 1991. Your patrol narrowly avoided fatal hypothermia. Of all the things that you could think about in a combat situation that might kill you, I think hypothermia would probably be down the bottom of many people's lists, including mine. However, hypothermia is serious, serious business. So how did the situation come to be, and how did you all manage to survive it?
The hypothermia is very, very serious. And it come about because of various things. Is that at first, is the weather. We were told that we were going to have a very, very, very mild English spring-type weather in Iraq. It was going to be similar to a spring in UK. And obviously, Patrick, you have no control over the weather itself. And in fact, it was one of the coldest winters that they'd had on record within Iraq. And it was sub-zero temperatures. And so we don't have any control over the weather. So that was one factor. And yes, the way we can deal with hypothermia, it's a very, very serious condition. And in the regiment, we are trained in this to basically recognise it, because recognising the early signs, well, then you can do something about it. And what people don't realise about hypothermia is that the mind goes fairly early. And what I mean by that is that you become confused, you become foggy, you become lethargic, you feel quite tired and don't know what to do. For example, if Des in the patrol starts to act a little bit strange and erratic, well, then it's a very good chance that Des is going down with hypothermia. And obviously the members of my patrol would notice this. So within the regiment, and especially within your close-knit patrol, you are always monitoring each other and looking for signs that don't look right. So that's one thing, because if you have clarity of mind, you are able to do something about it. And that doing something about it are sometimes relatively simple techniques. And one of them is layering of clothing, and we actually call it the layered method. And so in a cold environment, you place on your body as many layers of clothing as you can. And they don't have to be thick layers. They can be quite thin, because what happens is when you put on several layers, you trap air between them layers, and that air creates warmth. So putting on layers of clothing creates more heat in the body. So that's one. Another one is very basic, but having hot drinks and hot food. Now, when we was out in Iraq, we're on a routine called hard routine. And for obvious reasons, you can't cook food and you can't heat hot drinks, simply because you don't want to be compromised by the enemy. But because at that time it was so cold and we realized that we were fighting the elements, what we did, we broke that routine and we started to get hot food down us and make hot drinks. And obviously food is calories. Calories in the body creates energy, and energy creates heat within the body. So I mean, food and hot drinks creating heat within, this is obviously one of the more sensible things to do. And also, it's a psychological thing. Patrick, how many times have you been in a cold environment and you decide to go to a vendor and you have a hot drink and it just makes you feel good? So psychologically, it makes you feel good as well. Another technique is kind of sharing body warmth. I've been in situations where a guy has been injured, even shot even, and his temperature will plummet because of that. So we place him in a sleeping bag, and another guy will get in the sleeping bag with him to create more warmth. So what we did in the Gulf, we found that you can still keep alert, but keep close together, which creates heat amongst pairs, if you like. There's other things you can do is by getting out of the wind chill, because sometimes the temperature can lower, but the wind chill, the wind itself, can lower the temperature even further. So what you do, you can get around buildings, behind a wall. And in our case, it was behind the vehicles to prevent the wind chill from getting to us. So a lot of these techniques are quite basic. So the first one is the mental side, is just making sure that you're not acting erratic or strange. The other one is the layered method of layered clothing, hot drinks, hot food, and shared body warmth. And out in Iraq, when it was bitterly cold, we employed these techniques. Probably one thing that I want to point out, which is quite sobering really, is that at that time out there in the Gulf in 1991, is that the Iraqi desert was so cold that members of my regiment and guys that I know died of hypothermia. Simply, the weather was too cold. Yes, another factor is logistics. And logistics is equipment. And sometimes, because of the speed of the conflict and how fast it moves along, getting the equipment to marry up with you at the same time, so bringing cold weather gear in, as in clothing and equipment, it doesn't always happen fast enough. So logistics play a role as well. Also as well, there is the role that we were playing is that initially we weren't going in as the Bravo patrols. We had two large squadrons, which was A squadron and D squadron, which was forming up on the border ready to move across into the Iraqi desert. And all we were there to support them. We were there really to, if there was any casualties or any deaths, we were battle casualty replacements. And that was our role at the beginning. But the speed of ops and the way it goes is that things change very, very quickly. So the weather, the logistics, and the roles that you play within the conflict change all the time. And obviously, you don't have any control over that.
Okay, then moving on to the last couple of questions, but I think this is one that civilians like me probably often ask people like you that have served in the armed forces. It's an obvious question, but I think it's a really important one. I'm sure you've been asked it before, but here we go. Were you ever scared, Des, and how do you prepare yourself mentally and physically for such a grueling and potentially fatal endeavour?
Yes, the answer to that is yes. In fact, scared all the time. In fact, I was asked this question just a few weeks ago. Someone said, Des, what's the most scared you've ever been? And is that I said earlier on that I joined air troop in the SAS, and that is high altitude free fall parachuting. And this is a very, very scary endeavor. Is just to set the scene, you are normally in an aircraft 25,000 feet up in the air, and you are breathing oxygen. You are carrying weights of over 200 pounds. This is your military equipment. This is your weapon. And you are then breathing oxygen. It is normally cold. You're jumping at night. And then when you exit the aircraft with your patrol, it could be four men, six men, eight men, you are reaching speeds in the air in free fall in excess of over 120 mile an hour. And you find that your equipment is freezing up. Your altimeters will freeze, your goggles will freeze, and the equipment that you're breathing will also freeze. There's also problems of colliding in the air. And also, you're also trying to find your own space within the air so you don't collide with equipment, so you can land safely. And as you can appreciate, this is very, very scary. So every time someone says to me, what's the most scariest time? I always say, high altitude free fall parachuting, especially at night and especially in a cold environment.
Absolutely petrifying. I can't begin to imagine what it's like. Thank you for sharing that, Des. So before we wrap up and go through the details of the book, is there anything else that you would wish to add before we conclude or re-highlight or reiterate that perhaps the questions that I've asked, my limited, short-sighted questions, haven't given you the chance to talk about?
I suppose the book itself, I'm really pleased that it's coming out. And I think if there's anything that anyone can get from this book, especially in what's happened with the pandemic, is that I think reading the book, you may be able to gain some sort of strength, if you like. And I always think of it like this, is that if a guy from me, who originated from Sheffield, who worked in the steelworks, and then eventually joined the parachute regiment, and then joined the SAS, and then eventually writes a book and talks about it, well, then if I can do it, anyone can do it. But yes, so if anyone gets anything from this book, hopefully it's that message.
An inspiring one at that, Des. Thank you very much indeed. So let's talk about the book then. When and where can people get hold of this? We'll no doubt be running some competitions for the Versus History social media pages, but if someone wants to go out and spend their hard-earned cash to buy it, when and where can they get hold of this, Des?
Yes, it's coming out this month, the 28th of October. You will see that you can get it from most major bookstores and from all major supermarkets. On social media, there will be links on my social media and on Damien's social media as well. And you can order it from Amazon and from Quercus Publishing itself as well.
That's absolutely great. Well, on behalf of myself, the listeners, and the co-editors of Versus History Des, we've been honoured to have you with us today. It's been great to hear your story so eloquently put and so detailed, so insightful. I just can't wait to get hold of the book. I've not read it yet, but when it comes out, I'll be grabbing a copy and I'll buy another one to put it up for a competition on Versus History. So listeners, please keep your eyes and ears peeled. And if you want to get a copy gratis on behalf of me, just stay tuned. Des, well, thank you very much for giving up your time to come and talk to us today. All the best to you and Damien on this book, SAS Bravo 30. It's going to be an absolute barn burner. So thanks for sharing your time with us and your expertise to talk to us all about your new book, SAS Bravo 30.
Thank you very much, Patrick, and thank you very, very much for inviting me on your show.
You can come back anytime. All the best, Des.
Okay, bye-bye, Patrick.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.